Welcome to the Social Podcast, where no discussion or debate is off limits.
Hello and welcome to The Social. Melissa is off, but joining us today is journalist and co-founder of the podcast company Media Girlfriends, Hannah Song. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Hannah, it's great to see you and your beautiful hair. Let's get right into today's topics, okay? Would treating big tech like big tobacco help snuff out misinformation? The U.S. Surgeon General is making a case for just that. Dr. Vivek Murthy is calling fake news a public health hazard that requires aggressive action from social media giants. What's your reaction to this?
Yeah, I absolutely agree that there should be more regulation of social media, because if you think about tech platforms, really, it's about their bottom line and profits. And I don't really know how that benefits our democracy. We've seen many times how social media has played out, for example, the last couple of elections in the States, you know, but in Canada, we are not immune, right? But I also think that technology changes so fast that government regulations can't really keep up and change at the pace that we need it to. So I also think that there are major underlying cultural issues that we need to look at. So not to take the focus away from what these tech platforms need to do, but as well, we need to look at other issues like media literacy. We need so much more of that. Loneliness also is an epidemic, according to the Canadian Mental Health Association. And I believe this is we've all kind of experienced social isolation during the pandemic. And really, when you think about what social media does, is that it kind of leverages or exploits our personal relationships with people in our lives, right? So we trust the people in our lives. When they drop us a link about vaccines or whatever it is, we may be more prone to believe in that because it's coming from a trusted source, which is like our mom or our cousin or our best friend. And if you don't have enough people in your life who are willing to have difficult conversations with you because you are indeed lonely and you don't have enough friends, which is a real issue, especially for seniors, and you may be more susceptible to the kinds of stuff that algorithms will feed you, you know?
Yeah, Hannah, I love that point so much. And I have a feeling that the Surgeon General isn't sort of suggesting, hey, you know, I think we should go the way of like a totalitarian state and we're going to control and censor the information you're getting. I think it's more like, hey, let's try to figure out a positive way forward. Like right now, we have billionaires going into space. You know, there are machines where you could clap or ask a voice in a box to turn on your lights for you. Surely we can come up with an algorithm that's going to push evidence-based medical and scientific information, peer-reviewed stuff ahead, you know, up top. Because right now we know that doesn't tend to be the way that it works. Even this morning when I was Googling this story to try to find a little more information, I Googled Surgeon General Media. The first link that came up was from Breitbart News. I don't know what that says about me, but I was also like, what?
That's a great point, Jess, because in 2017, the New York Times, there was a study that found that in 2017, if you did a search engine thing for climate change, the first links that popped up were from climate change deniers. So like it works in the opposite way, right? So there should be some tech to be able to address that.
Yeah, I mean, there's also
like a
seatbelt, issue,
you know?
I mean, I think these are all really good points. There's also been an issue, particularly recently, where influencers have been approached to actually spread misinformation and disinformation, that shady kind of advertising companies, this happened in France recently, have promised a lot of money to people. And so somebody was a whistleblower and outed that. But I mean, I can only imagine how often that's happening. So that needs to be clamped down on. The problem, I think, is what will be stopped. And this is, we're just talking about social media. So even if they could figure out a way in which to let lessen the misinformation, the fake news. The question I think becomes, what's stopping people from just creating a website and having, let's say, all kinds of misinformation on that website and having an email list where they email people? I just feel like this is maybe going to just, it's a Pandora's box, the internet, and this will just shift and change. So I agree with you, Hannah, that we need more education. But I think we also, I don't know that we're going to be able to fix this anytime soon.
Johanna on Facebook agrees with you, Cynthia. She wrote, do they not know what will happen if they try to control non-mainstream thinking / alternative information? Those sources will go underground. They'll find more clever ways to survive and replicate, kind of like a virus variant. And they'll get angrier, too, because they have been silenced. And Joanne, I totally agree with you. Like, if you're already prone to distrust your government, and in many cases with good reason, but if you're prone to think, you know, like, not to be too absurd, but like if a vaccine has, you know, magnets in it or that it's tracking your location, if you then find out that the government is sanctioning that these stories are pushed further and further down, that's going to light your fire.
Mm-hmm. And Karen on Facebook actually shares with us, social media companies need to change the algorithm they currently use, as it lets far too much false data to get through. Fear-mongering is at the base of these delusional beliefs, and they need to crack down on this methodology of false news and catastrophic thinking. Critical thinking needs to be taught, as well as how to process difficult emotions. So speaking to education, Hannah, as you said, and I think it's also, I mean, it is part of internet culture, period, not just social media, but just the internet, where, like, I feel like I come from a generation where I like to read long things. And when I click on an article on a website and it's this short, I'm not interested. I want the thing where the bar goes on and on and on. But I know, like, there's like an internet term for it. Too long didn't read. TLDR, right? Like, people are just like, you know, I don't have time to read this. And I personally don't understand that. But I think it stems from other issues, like, why don't people have time to read? Because they're so busy, because they have so many kids, because their workplaces don't provide for them, like, blah, 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 blah. So all of this is like layer upon layer of social issues that can't be addressed as a one-off. You have to have it in combination.
Totally agree.
Absolutely.
Algorithms, it's a good start. And now, there's something else to chew over. Restaurants across the country have been slowly reopening their dining rooms. And researchers cited in the Toronto Star say eating indoors is a social experience that serves up a really unique psychological response. So here's the question. Do you miss indoor dining? Are you booking tables?
Moment, I do not at all. And I think that's pandemic related. I can't think of anything more anxiety inducing at the moment. Even patios, I have a little bit of anxiety. And I actually am trying to go out this Friday and was finding it impossible to find a patio. I would love to find one. Anyway, when I think back, yes, there are elements of certain restaurants being indoors that I miss. But did you find increasingly over the past few years that a lot of restaurants, particularly in urban centers, everybody's like jammed together and like really close. Like, if I can like smell the neighbor's food and hear their conversations, I mean, that's can be entertaining sometimes, but I feel like it's too close. And that, don't even get me started on that communal dining. If I go to a restaurant where you're supposed to like share a table, I am out. I'm out.
I have to say that I actually love the big communal tables. But, you know, I'm with you, Cynthia. Really. I love talking to strangers. I'm an extreme extrovert. What can I say? But I also don't really miss the indoor dining. I do miss the restaurant experience. And I did go to my first patio recently and I had an amazing dinner with an amazing server. And it just like hit me with a blast how much I had missed that experience. But it being summer right now, I don't need to be inside. And I know that I might feel differently this fall and winter. I will stay outside for as long as I possibly can. And I also feel a little bit of anxiety, quite frankly, going inside. I went to get some takeout at a restaurant and I saw a couple of people doing the indoor dining thing. And I just thought, why? You know, it's not December. I did not have any desire to be doing that right now.
Oh, you said it, Hannah.
I totally agree. Go ahead, Jess.
I was just going to say the idea of that perfect dining experience is something I missed, like where you don't know what's happening around you. You've lost all control because really good restaurateurs and servers are taking care of you. They have the lighting right. They have the right music at the right volume. They can read the table, know that you're the type of people that are maybe having an intense conversation and you just want delicious food and your wine glass to be filled up. Or you're the kind of person who wants the owner coming over every 2 minutes to be like, and, you know, doing a little jokey joke. You know, all of this happens. It happens really well, and you don't know what's happening. That's magic.
Yeah, I am with you in the sense of I too am not ready to indoor dine, but I do miss it because number one, I do go to patios now, and I hate eating outside. I hate the fact that this is the reality. I don't like the fumes from the cars coming into my face. And outdoor dining always involves a table where one of the legs doesn't fall flat on the
You're
thing.
Right.
And you
You're
always right. get that table. I hate the patio for that reason. But also what I miss about the communal table, Cynthia, and FYI, we're going to go and you're going to love it, is there is nothing like indoor dining at a Chinese restaurant with a round table and a lazy Susan in the middle where you spin that thing and you have 10 dishes that you can pick from noodles to pork to beef to duck to all those things. And my God, do I cannot wait for a Chinese meal indoors on a lazy Susan. Please, can we take care of ourselves and make that happen again?
So here's a question. Do you have a Chandler, Joey, or Samantha in your life? A piece in Scary Mommy calls glamorous depictions of friend groups on television unrealistic. It says that friendships are simply way harder to maintain in real life. So do you think that television needs to do a better job at reflecting real life relationships or friendships in particular?
Well, I have to admit that sometimes, like, you'll be watching a TV show or several TV shows and you'll come away and be like, why don't I have, like, a Kramer in my life? Just someone who comes over not just once a day, but several times a day, you know, to steal some cereal. Or why don't I have a group of girlfriends that goes, you know, regularly for brunch every Saturday or Sunday? I have never had that. But I certainly understand why TV does it. They have to have like these regular storylines, you know, where their characters meet up for some continuity and life isn't TV. But at the same time, it is kind of possible. Like before the pandemic, my dad would go grocery shopping with his best friend every Sunday. And there's something about that I love. I've just never had it in my own personal life. I don't know if that's on me or if it's just my group of friends that were kind of tend to be maintenance free, if you will.
Hannah?
Hannah, go ahead.
Oh, well, sure. Yeah. I have to say that this doesn't really resonate with me. And I do feel that maybe it's because I have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to female friendships in my life. I feel so lucky and I have always had amazing female friendships. But you know, when these shows like Friends or Sex and the City, when I think about them, I don't find anything in them particularly realistic. So I don't have the expectation that the female friendships in them will be like mine in real life. You know, those shows are kind of meant to be funny and aspirational, I suppose. And I will say that I have felt a real lack of storytelling around, you know, other aspects of my life. So, for example, growing up in an immigrant family, what it's like to have a culture gap in your own home, basically the kind of stories around anybody who is not rich or white. Those are the kinds of storylines that I have felt the lack of. The female friendship territory, I feel, is quite well trod. And I, of course, always want more perspectives, but I haven't felt the lack of that personally.
Yeah, it's always been so laughable that both Sex and the City and Friends in New York City had no diversity when it came to their friendships. That's always been, I think, very cringeworthy for lots of people. I mean, for me, I just think while we've talked on the show before about how romantic relationships in Hollywood and film and television, I think they do or can do a number, particularly the era that we four pretty much grew up in, which was a lot of depictions of like the bad boy is the guy you want to get and change. Or, you know, most movies and television shows sort of end at the place where they get together and they don't really show you like the sort of day-to-day drudgery. And I do think that sets up unrealistic expectations. But I agree with you. Like when it comes to female friendships and in mother-daughter relationships too, like who looked at Gilmore Girls and was like, oh, that's the relationship that I would like to aspire to with my mother? No one. So I think that the female friendship thing, I can't relate. I have friends from all kinds of different backgrounds. The one thing that maybe is in common is they don't know any of each other. In fact, I don't think it was until this show that I actually have gone out in a group setting with all women, with you guys. That's really it, Lainey, I gotta say.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I think that, to be honest, this article, I mean, I didn't relate to it. And I know that it was this person's opinion, but I think their opinion is wrong. Because I'm not sure why they're generalizing about television's depiction of female friendships using television references that are 15 years old. Like, you know, you would make a stronger point if you're using television shows from the now. We already know the problem with pop culture. Hannah, you just talked about it. Cynthia, you just talked about it. All these white stories about white people. But the television of now, we're in a golden age of television. So if we're talking about female friendships, you have a show where, Cynthia, you talked about romances. The central romance of this show called Insecure is the friendship between Molly and Issa. And the cliffhanger at the end of the last season, and we're going into the final season, is whether or not Issa and Molly are going to get back together as friends. So to me, that's pretty realistic. Friends in their 20s and early 30s who differ in their experiences and then kind of break up over conflict. And how do they find their way back? I'm pretty sure a lot of people can relate to that. I certainly can. And, you know, even in the now, when we're talking about one of the most popular comedies on TV, that would be Ted Lasso, just nominated for a record-breaking number of Emmy Awards. You think that show is about a football team? Well, in Variety, to promote its second season, they didn't talk about the dudes or Jason Sudeikis, the creator. They used the two female characters on this show because it's their friendship that's one of the strongest parts of Ted Lasso. The reason why? Half the writer's room of that show is women. Most of the writers on Insecure are women. So when we're talking about depiction of female friendship in art, look to the people who are making art right now. And if the people who are making art are actually women who have had experience with friendships, chances are they'll speak to you. So, you know, I would like to sort of send a note to this writer from Scary Mommy who was like, these shows don't speak to me. Well, maybe try watching TV that isn't 15 years old. Anyway, I'll leave that there. And we're going to move on to something a little bit different. Let's talk about tarot cards. A writer for The Guardian breaks down how she navigated her doubts when a friend pulled out a deck over dinner. Do you think there's a value, there's any value in a tarot card reading?
Well, I'll jump in by saying I've never had my tarot cards read, and I don't know if there's value in the tarot cards themselves, but while I don't believe in tarot cards or astrology or like psychic palm reading stuff, I do believe in their ability to be basically the gateway drug for talking about yourself and reflecting on your life. And if that's what gets you in there, I think that's cool. You know, a long time ago when I was in my 20s, I went to see a psychic, even though I was saying to myself, I don't believe in them, just like this woman was saying she doesn't believe in tarot cards. But this session ended up being very long and very emotional. And at the end of it, I said to this woman who called herself an intuitive, I said, can I come see you again? And she said, no, because I always say to people, if you need to see a psychic more than once a year, what you really need is therapy. And I said to her, oh my God,
an ethical psychic.
An honest psychic. That's beautiful.
She was amazing. And she was absolutely right. I'm a huge proponent of therapy. If you can access it, wonderful. Do it. Find the right person for you. But that was like an amazing moment, obviously, because really what she was doing was not reading my future or my past or my card. She was reading me. And I appreciated that because I kind of needed that perspective at that moment.
Yeah. There was a, when I was 16, I went through a real hippie phase, and there was this dude I fell in love with who pierced my nose for me. He also gave me my first deck of tarot cards that were very dreamy. I have them somewhere. And so I really got into it for a while. I was reading for other people. I was reading my own and so on. But I always did take it with a grain of salt. I found it fun. And I think you read into these what you want to see. But I will say I did have a strange experience when I was pregnant. I hadn't told any of my colleagues. I was only like maybe a couple months pregnant. And so it was, I was keeping it a secret. And we did a shoot where I had to be interviewing a Wiccan woman, a witch, and she was going to read my tarot cards. And she said, we'll just do a simple reading. I don't want to get into it while you have camera people here because there may be something that you're hiding. And she just looked right at me. And I was like, maybe she meant anything. I didn't have much else that I was hiding, but I just felt like the way that she looked at me afterwards was like, she knows. Anyway, I'll never really know if she knew, but it felt like she did.
Lainey, what about you?
I think that it's whatever works for anybody. My mother and I are superstitious in like the Chinese feng shui way. But I just do think that the tarot card thing would be more effective for me if like one out of every 10 clients, the tarot card like reader would say, looking at the cards, no, I'm not getting anything, nothing. Like I have no reading on you whatsoever, no vibes. Like, cause how can you bat 10 out of 10? Like LeBron James doesn't even hit every free throw. He misses like once a year. So I would love for a tarot card reader just to be like, oh, not today, man. I don't have the radar.
Okay, Paul on Facebook says, I have read tarot cards since 1970. I have no psychic ability, but people say I'm bang on usually. I call most readings lucky guesses. It even surprises me when people say how accurate I was. I tell people not to live and die by the readings. One should never plan their life according to what cards were drawn and interpreted. Paul, that's really, really honest. I've never had my tarot cards read, but I kind of like this. It's kind of like a Rorschach test, you know? You see what you want to see.
Maybe I'm going to have to dig out my tarot cards and give you a reading at some point, Jess.
Subscribe to The Social Podcast so you don't miss a fiery debate. Until next time, socialites.